Morning.
Good morning.
It's great to be here again. As I mentioned last night, this is our fifth Mountains and Waters Sesshin here at Sea to Sky Retreat Center. And plus we had our third women's retreat here recently. So I've become very fond of this place. The forest, the rocks, the water. And it's a particularly good place for this particular sesshin. We call it Mountains and Waters Sesshin after Dogen's Mountains and Waters Sutra. And we try and incorporate really receiving the teachings of the mountains and waters in this beautiful environment, and to include practice outdoors, which we'll talk about shortly. So this year we're going to practice with listening to the sounds of this place, within and without, and to the silence of this place. Back in 2012, we had a day retreat out at our place in Blue Mountain Zendo. And was anybody here there? I don't think so. It was maybe just before we moved the Zendo to Wall Street, or just after. So a lot has changed since then. And even then, this day retreat, we called it What is the Sound? And it was a day of listening practice. Lee, were you there? Oh, right. At least. And at the time, we thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a more extended time to practice with this very rich practice of listening? So that's what we decided. These few days that we'll be here, we'll share with you some perspectives on listening, sound, and silence. Everything from the avant-garde composers and musicians John Cage and Pauline Oliveros, to a fellow named Gordon Hempton, who is an acoustic ecologist. He goes all around the world recording sound environments. To Hakuin Zenji, the 17th century Zen Rinzai Zen master, who kind of revived Rinzai practice in Japan and originated the very famous koan, What is the Sound of One Hand Clapping? And then, of course, to Dogen Zenji, who founded our particular school of Zen in Japan, brought it from this way of practice from China to Japan. And then we'll go back to the Shurangama Sutra, which is a Mahayana text that was, it's believed to have been translated from Sanskrit to Chinese in the 8th century. So that's as far back as we'll go, but really much further. And we'll give you some specific practices and some experiments to do with listening over these coming days. We live in a very predominantly visual culture these days, with such visual overload that many people have difficulty sleeping. I won't ask for a show of hands, but I'll bet that a significant portion of folks here have difficulty with sleep. And research has shown that, you know, visual stimulation, overstimulation is part of that. So, you know, we're advised, if we have trouble with insomnia, to get off screen, you know, well before going to bed, among other things. Our audio overload is considerable too. What with ubiquitous noise pollution in our urban environments. So most of us are used to tuning out, to filtering, because we can't take it all in, right? So we filter the sounds that come. We even tune out to what people say. Selective listening, we've heard that. But we don't really listen attentively, because we don't... We talk through our screens. Our listening is mediated much more through the visual. We're distracted by that, and we don't, you know, we're rehearsing what we're going to say next. We're evaluating what we're saying as we try and say it, text it, and yeah. So we've lost attentive listening, or at least we've jeopardized it. But hearing is perhaps the sense that can teach us most if we really attend to the practice of listening, that can teach us most about perception, mind, and consciousness. We can close our eyes. We can't close our ears. It's very hard to fully block if you've, you know, used earplugs. It's hard to fully block sound. We can feel the vibrations of sound even through our bodies, with our feet. Have you ever, probably not in person, you may have even in person, witnessed, heard a performance of the famous percussionist, classical percussionist, who is profoundly deaf. Her name's Dame Evelyn Glennie. She's British. And she performs barefoot, even in a symphony concert performance. It's wonderful to watch. And there's a really good documentary about her. I forget the title, but if you Google it, Glennie, you can track it down. Don't know if it's even available online, but it's fascinating. When we attend closely to the arising and passing of sound, we can learn how to attend to the arising and passing of thoughts, memories, emotions. The inner soundscape of our mind is very like the outer soundscape in many ways. The American composer Pauline Oliveros teaches a practice she calls deep listening. And this is what she says: "For me, deep listening is a lifetime practice. The more I listen, the more I learn to listen. Deep listening involves going below the surface of what is heard and also expanding the whole field of sound, whatever one's usual focus might be. This is the way to connect with the acoustic environment and all that inhabits it." So that's what we're going to do right here. Oliveros once made a proposal to create a deep listening palace for a conference on, believe it or not, utopia in Potsdam, Netherlands. So I'm going to read from her proposal, but I'm going to substitute the word temple for the word palace when she says palace, because it feels more suitable, actually, to create a sacred space of listening practice. So here's how it goes. "The temple can be anywhere there is time, space, and a listener. A time and space could be defined by drawing a circle on the ground or building an edifice. The temple is anywhere and everywhere. Or we could say sitting down on our zafu. The listener is there to perceive the temple and what it contains. Listeners may come together to share their experiences of deep listening, listening below the surface, listening to everything during a suspension of judging and criticizing. A listening utopia would mean that all citizens entered the temple at any time and practice listening, listening to and for oneself, listening to and for others. A practice, a discipline. Listening is actively attending to the life of the mind and the mind of life and its temple. Temple is the body and its expansiveness. Temple is time, space, to house the splendor of the reception of what is. Just listening allows what is to be present or for the present to be." Oh, sorry, I'm going to read that again. My emphasis wasn't right. "Just listening allows what is to be present and for the present to be. What is all, past, present, future, all at once, all there to be received if one is listening." Isn't that a beautiful concept, a temple of listening? So It reminds me of the wonderful story I love of the Buddha walking out with his assembly of followers, and he stops and says, "This is a good place to build a temple." And Indra, the king of gods, just happens to be among the assembly, reaches down, plucks a blade of grass, and puts the blade of grass into the ground and says, "There, it has been built." And the Buddha smiles. Great. Now we have a temple. So that's all you have to do, is say, right here, we have created, and that's what we're going to do, create a sacred space for listening practice together. So as a kind of invocation of that, we're going to just... let's chant it, because, you know, chanting resonates more than just speaking in a speaking voice. This is Pauline Oliveira's, it really is kind of an invocation, and it's called the listening field. And because in traditional cultures, so much of chant and song is done in call and response, we're going to alternate lines. We're going to divide the room. Martin, you're right in the middle, so you can choose which side you're on. But you don't have to move. Okay, you're on that side. So everybody on this side is going to chant the first line, and everybody on this side is going to chant the alternate line. Okay? So I'll start with this side to get us started. Ready? Oh, could I borrow a bell? Thank you.
Good catch.
So we just, you know, start it the proper way. Open your heart to sound.
Sound to your open heart.
Open sound.
Open heart.
Sound to open.
Heart to open.
Heart sound.
Sound heart.
Heart open.
Sound open.
Sound to open your heart.
Heart to open your sound.
Your sound, your heart.
Sound your heart.
Open the heart to sound.
Sound to open your heart to sound.
Sound to open your sound to heart.
Your heart is sound.
Your sound is heart.
Your sound is open.
Your heart is open.
Your heart.
Your sound.
You are open.
You are heart.
You are sound.
Thank you. So now, let's start listening practice. So take a comfortable posture. And unlike our regular Zazen practice, I'm going to invite you to close your eyes, if you'd like. And let's start by sitting here and bringing our attention to the subtle sounds of our own bodies. Start with the breath, the in-breath and out-breath, and see if you can hear your breath. Don't exaggerate the breath in any way. Just listen and see what you hear. See if you notice a difference between the in-breath and the out-breath. Just let the breath come and go without effort and listen. Now notice also any other sounds that your body makes. Abdominal sounds, maybe swallowing. Subtle little click if you move your neck. How do we hear those sounds? Do we hear those sounds from inside the body or from outside? Are those sounds accompanied by sensations of movement or pressure? How loud do they sound? The sounds your body makes. Can you hear your heartbeat? Put your hand over your heart and now see if you can hear your heartbeat. Are you hearing with your ears or in some other way? Now expand your awareness to the sounds of within the room, and the sounds that other people make, or the building itself. Don't worry about exactly what it is you're hearing. Just allow any sounds within the building to come and go. And then allow your field of awareness to extend to sound outside the building. It may feel like the building is another layer, like our skin. There are sounds within and sounds without. The building gives us a layer of protection. Notice any sounds that come to your awareness. And also notice any resonance or reaction from your own body. Where do you feel that response? If there is one, and is it a sense of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? Just as in Zazen practice, when the mind wanders, when the mind is agitated or sluggish, you bring the attention more deliberately back to your breath, the sensations of your breath, You can do the same thing with bringing your attention to sound, brightening your awareness of sound when the mind wanders. Can you still hear the bell? There. Okay, thank you for doing that. That's just an introduction to an invitation to practice this way with sound. And I really want to encourage you to do that consistently. You know, to take up that practice for these few days that we're here in just that way. You know, you can start with the body, and then extend to the room and out further. This is a really nice bell, so it rings for a long time. Mm-hmm. So when the bells ring, what would we do in Zen practice without our bells and our percussion? You know, those are really part of our practice. You know, in a monastery, you can pretty much let go of checking the time, because everything is signaled by bells or the han. The layout here, you know, doesn't quite work for that. But yeah, those Zen sound effects are a really important part of our practice. I think I've been doing listening practice my whole life. I, you know, grew up early childhood roaming the fields and the woods around my house, pretty much since I could walk. I think, you know, I set out to roam, and so there are birds that I've known from their songs and calls since childhood, because my mom taught me to listen to them. I feel I know them as my neighbors, each place I live, because I learn not only what they look like, but what their voices are, how to recognize their voices. When Michael and I first came to see the sky, we came to do week-long solo retreats, back-to-back. We stayed in the cabin that we are in now, which is at the far end of the property and sort of up a little higher, overlooking the lake. So you see the lake sparkling down below, surrounded by forest. And in the morning and in the evening, I would listen to what seemed like hundreds of Swainson's thrushes in full chorus. Now, because it was, this morning it was cool and rainy, and so I didn't really hear them, but if you hear a thrush, some of you know, that sort of spirals up, and it goes so high it sounds like it's going beyond our hearing ability. I think of it as the spiral thrush. And it's a very drab little thrush, very plain brown. You don't actually see them very often, but you hear them. It's one of the last songbirds to arrive in the spring, because it comes all the way from South America, unlike the robins who hang around. But as I sat day after day listening to these thrushes, I began to hear individual differences in their spiral patterns. And the ones that I could identify, the ones that had their territories closer and farther away from me. So I could scope out the thrush neighborhood from slight differences in their songs. So I hope you will get to know some of our bird neighbors these days. You may or may not know what they are, but you may learn to recognize their songs and their calls. You might hear from the ospreys, who nest every year just below on the ridge down there. So you might hear the ospreys calling, or the young ospreys calling to their parents. Or you might hear the pikas, who live in the rocks here. Do you know what pikas are? They're about this big. They're also called rock rabbits, but they have little round ears instead of like rabbit ears. And they make hay and store. They actually cut grass and wildflowers and make little piles of hay, and then cure it. Once the hay cures, they take it into their little burrows for the wintertime. And they make a very high nasal sound. Do you hear that? It's not a bird, it's a pika. Okay. And I also want to encourage you to listen to the spaces between sounds, the silences. And if you listen to the silences, what else do you hear? Are they silent? John Cage was a 20th century American avant-garde composer and artist who had a lifelong interest in silence. He wrote a book, a compilation of his talks and essays called Silence. And by some miracle, I found that in high school. And my little private high school notebooks have little quotes from John Cage. And he said, "There is no such thing as silence. Something is always happening that makes a sound." And the reason he knows that, or knew that, is that he had a pivotal experience in 1952 that changed his understanding of silence. He heard that acoustical engineers at Harvard had created an anechoic chamber, completely soundproof room. And he arranged to spend time in it. He really wanted to do this. And when he emerged, he announced to the engineers it didn't work. Uh-huh. He'd heard two humming sounds, one high-pitched and one low. And they said, "Oh, everyone hears those. The low one is your blood circulating and the high one is your nervous system." Wow. So, if you go somewhere quiet enough, you can hear your nervous system and your blood circulating. And it's still not completely silent. Now, you may have heard, Cage is famous for his musical composition called 4 Minutes 33 Seconds, during which the pianist plays nothing at all. The pianist comes in, sits down at the piano, opens the piano, and then sits. I forget the span. Closes the piano. That's the first movement. Opens it again, sits, closes it again, that's the second movement, and then one more time, three movements. This was quite outrageous to those who listened, and many complained. But others were fascinated to realize that there was the sound of the environment during each of those three movements. So it wasn't silent. There was the music of everyday life or whatever was happening. There were sirens, depending on where the location was, wind. And Cage was very, very interested in this music of random ambient sound. And he did many wild experiments with music and sound and randomness. And he was deeply influenced by the writings and lectures of D.T. Suzuki, who wrote many books about Zen and lectured through the 50s about Zen. Rinzai Zen, he was not a monk, he was not ordained, but he had done lay practice, and he was a scholar. And he was hugely influential in introducing Zen philosophy and art to the West. And John Cage was only one of many artists and poets and musicians who were inspired by D.T. Suzuki. And so he saw his artistic practice as an exercise in attention and awareness, often to what normally goes unnoticed, rather than as an expression of his personality. He tried to completely efface his personality in his music. So this is what Cage said. He said, listening one takes as a springboard the first sound that comes along. The first something springs us into nothing, and out of that nothing arises the next something, etc. Does this sound like Zazen? Like an alternating current. And then he says, no one sound fears the silence that extinguishes it. But if you avoid that silence, that's a pity, because it resembles life very closely. And life and it are essentially a cause for joy. No one sound fears the silence that extinguishes it. No one life need fear the silence that extinguishes it. Mm. And if we avoid it, that's a pity, because that silence resembles life very closely. And life and it are essentially a cause for joy. It's sort of a credo for John Cage's life. From all accounts, as he matured in his music practice and art practice and Zen practice, he became this, he was always smiling, and he was exceedingly generous in just sharing his practice with others. He was known for that. And yeah. So remember Dogen Zenji's famous lines. Many of you know these for sure, have them memorized. To study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. So this is our listening practice. We listen to the sounds within and without that come to us inside out or outside in. In the same way that Dogen asks us to practice in Zazen. Lewis Hyde, who is a wonderful interdisciplinary thinker and writer, also Zen influenced. He did a scholar's residence at Green Gulch, San Francisco Zen Center years back. He, in this book called Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership, he talks about the cultural commons and the enclosure of the cultural commons, intellectual property rights, a complex, fascinating book. But he talks about silence as a resource for human culture and well-being. He said, it's a very old idea that human beings and their cultures are renewed by quitting the familiar and going, in fact, or in imagination, or we might say in a zendo, to the desert. In many traditions, the young must go into silence or wilderness before they can emerge as real persons. It is not enough to take instruction. There has to be some contact with what lies outside our knowledge, which is to say, with our collective ignorance, how large it is and how fertile. So silence as this kind of deep resource. Resource of creativity, resource of insight, resource of awakening. Pauline Oliveros, who was directly influenced by John Cage and was a friend of John Cage, so again, these lineages. says these forms of listening are essential to the process of unlocking layer after layer of imagination, meaning, and memory down to the cellular level of human existence. Sadly, silence, or even quiet, has become a scarce resource in our daily lives. I mentioned Gordon Hempton, the acoustic ecologist who goes around the world making sound recordings of both natural and the human-created soundscapes. And he went on a kind of quest to find a place, even deep in the wilderness, where with an absence of human-generated sounds. Because, of course, you know, jet traffic goes over the poles frequently, yeah. And he found it very difficult to find such a place where there's no human-generated sound for more than a few minutes of silence. He's clocked probably more hours of deep listening than most people. And he says, silence is not the absence of something, but the presence of everything. Mm. We might substitute the Buddhist term, emptiness is not the absence of something, but the presence of everything. Mm. Maybe that's why listening to sounds and the silences between them teaches us about form and emptiness through our direct experience of listening. Here's what Gordon Hempton says. He says, a quiet place outdoors has no physical borders or limits to perception. One can commonly hear for miles and listen even farther. A quiet place affords a sanctuary for the soul, where the difference between right and wrong becomes more readily apparent. It is a place to feel the love that connects all things, large and small, human and not. A place where the presence of a tree can be heard. A quiet place is a place to open up all your senses and come alive. So, Gordon Hempton has made it his mission to protect a square inch. That's, his book is called One Square Inch of Silence. A square inch of silence in Olympic National Park. And where he found sustained silence. And I don't know how his campaign is going. I tried to see on his website. He's campaigning to have two commercial jet routes altered to avoid passing over this silent spot. And his book tells of his journey, starting from his one square inch of silence to Washington, D.C. to present his case. And on the way, he visits various locations to investigate the state of quiet and noise. He goes to a state-of-the-art concert hall, a remote ranch in Montana. He goes to a company that produces high-tech ear protection gear and sound reduction technology. And he goes to a babbling brook once beloved of John Muir. It's quite an illuminating read, or I don't know what the oral equivalent of illuminating is. It's that. And there's a companion CD. You can listen to his soundscapes. And reading it gives you pause to consider how much excessive noise leading to hearing loss we each may have been exposed to in our lifetimes, especially those who've listened to, you know, very loud music or power tools sustained. I worry that the degree of hearing loss is only going to increase given what, you know, present generations are exposed to. At any rate, I make this digression into Hempton's work on sound and silence to encourage you, when you go home in a few days to notice the sound and the noise. We usually call noise sound that has, we label sound that we feel negatively towards noise, usually, right? Notice what you receive as sound, or even pleasant sound, versus what you perceive as noise. We take our hearing so much for granted. We've become inured to the, you know, to the level of ruckus, unprecedented in human history. You may start to notice what a relative thing quiet is. In his quest, Hampton went, as I said, to Washington, D.C., and he met with the director of the National Park System. And the director of the National Park System told him a story of canoeing on a lake very near Hampton's home, which I think is in Washington State, with a group of regional national park directors and two interns. And they were canoeing on this lake. And the interns were talking about the history of the area. And then they stopped talking and stopped rowing. And the director telling the story commented on how suddenly quiet it was. Hampton, hearing the story, was taken aback because he knew that lake, and he knew that lake was bordered by Highway 101, which he estimated at 2 p.m., which would have been the time this happened, there would have been scarcely a minute free of traffic noise. And he invited the director of National Parks to come to his square inch of silence and hear what true silence was. I was a little surprised, taken back myself, when I came here for the first time and doing my solo retreat up on the, overlooking the lake. And it is, in many respects, lovely. But I was surprised with the degree of traffic noise coming up from the Sea to Sky Highway. And some of you have probably noticed that, particularly the trucks and the trains that pass by. I liked sitting out on the cabin deck in the afternoons when there was a lovely breeze coming in and through the cedars and hemlocks, and it would mask the traffic noise. And even in the middle of the night, I could hear the pleasant trickle of the little stream going down the mountainside, and the distant dull roar of the spillway from the dam at the base of the other end of the lake. So even when it got really still, there were things I could hear. And then I went home to our house between Maple Ridge and Mission. And late at night, I was, oh, it's so still. It was so quiet at our house, more so than here. And then I realized that the frogs had stopped peeping, that when I had left, the frogs were still peeping, and when I got back, there's a point in July when the frogs stop peeping. We have an old beaver pond and a kind of marsh on two sides of our house, so the frogs, the tree frogs, Pacific tree frogs, make quite a chorus. And that reminded me of when I first lived in Japan. I rented a tiny house on the edge of a long swath of rice paddies with a little pine woods behind it and a tobacco field beside it. And on the opposite side of the rice paddies, there was a wide boulevard that divided the countryside from the campus of the university where both of us studied. And when I would bicycle across the narrow causeway crossing the rice paddies on a June evening, the frog chorus was deafening. It was really something. And the firefly light show was spectacular. But just as I'd be falling asleep, over above the frog chorus was the high whine of the local youth on their heavy plastic motorcycles zooming down the boulevard, sounding like a swarm of angry hornets. These were not big motorcycles, but they had a lot of plastic parts on them. So they made a really high whine. So I would pretend I was on some strange planet where the wildlife included very large nocturnal insects. And I would be grateful to be safe wrapped in my futon. So this brings the whole, these stories are to illustrate the relativity of noise, right? So which place, to a person accustomed to sleeping to traffic noise every night, which would be quieter? A really loud chorus of frogs, or the trucks and the train going by down below here? Each of us has our own karmic relationship to sound. What we find delightful, what we found maddening. Same with music. What we find delightful, what we find maddening. Or what we just simply don't notice or pay attention to. So as you pay attention to sounds in these coming days, as I said, notice your response. Delight, ease, startlement, irritation. Be aware of these responses as bodily sensations arising and passing as the sounds arise and pass. And then, just as we do in Zazen, return to a flowing, continuous awareness of sound and silence arising and passing, just as the breath flows in and out, just as thoughts arise and pass. So this practice is, as you know, pretty inexhaustible and all-inclusive. In this practice, we receive everything, we don't hold on to anything. So now we're going to chant. And so really listen as we chant. Listen to the chanting from within your body and outside your body. And then we'll bow and listen to the sounds of bowing, the sounds your body makes and our bodies make as we bow and our clothing swishing around. And then I'll tell you a little bit more about the outdoor practice we're going to do. Okay, so. May